This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
It's been more and more on the minds of the highway engineers to try to make the roads more sustainable in terms of what they have to interact with in the landscape.
Whither goest thou, America, in thy shiny car in the night? Jack Kerouac's On the Road perfectly captured the essence of the American fascination with the automobile. But that love affair has been dysfunctional, at least as far as the environment goes. This week on Sea Change Radio, I speak with Ginger Strand, a nonfiction writer who's written extensively on the American interstate. We discuss the history of American roads over the past 5 decades, efforts to protect wildlife in the face of road encroachment, and the evolution of hitchhiking as the rideshare movement continues to blossom. Then we revisit my conversation with Paul Minot, the founder of the Ridesharing Institute in Auckland, New Zealand, and Mark Svenvold, a journalist who's profiled Minot's work. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by nonfiction author Ginger Strand. Ginger, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Hi, glad to be here.
So Ginger, your last book was called Killer on the Road, Violence in the American Interstate. How does our vast interstate system connect to sustainability issues?
Well, the first thing that happened, I would say, is that the highway system, along with a couple of other developments, urban renewal being a big one, drove a sort of redevelopment of the nation in a completely unsustainable way. So we had suburbanization, we had sprawl, we had the evacuation of our inner cities by middle class and affluent people. And they, you know, it very quickly became apparent that this was not the best of all possible worlds, that this was in fact that the interstates were driving an unsustainable course of development, and people tried to reverse that. One of the interesting movements in doing that was, in addition to what was known as the freeway revolts in urban areas where people rose up and stopped freeways from happening. That certainly happened in San Francisco, which is one of the cities in the nation that's least dominated by interstate highways. But also hitchhikers and the counterculture generally in the 60s and 70s through hitchhiking tried to kind of rewrite the interstates as a place of connection and as a place of, you know, a more sustainable form of transit through the sharing of rides and through not owning cars.
Yes, we've done several pieces on ride sharing here on Sea Change Radio, and it's great to see people sharing the roads like they used to, but I couldn't help but wonder why we don't see any more hitchhikers on the road. Why is that?
Yeah, well, there was a very concerted effort to kill hitchhiking. Partly, hitchhiking was understood to be a countercultural activity, and students were using it to get to civil rights movements. They were going to the South to register voters. All of this really bothered J. Edgar Hoover, head of the FBI at the time, and he started a campaign to convince people that hitchhiking was dangerous. You know, there were some highly publicized cases of people who preyed on hitchhikers, but no one ever really studied the issue. There was one study done in the 70s by the California Department of Highways, which established that hitchhiking was actually not significantly more dangerous than walking down the street. So it was at the same time, local law enforcement, you know, seeing it as a sort of, you know, something that long hairs and hippies did, crack down on it and passed out brochures and, you know, ran public re-education campaigns that basically turned this into something that, you know, was considered to be practically playing Russian roulette. You know, by the time I was growing up, my mother was, you know, had me convinced that if I ever stuck out my thumb, you know, it was a one-way ticket to hell.
Oh, me too. Yeah, it was something that you were just not ever supposed to consider. I remember doing it in New Zealand, where it was completely part of the culture, and just feeling quite free in terms of not needing a car and just sticking out your thumb, getting a ride. It was great, but that was in a very quote-unquote safe country in a small place, but it probably was no safer than doing it in California. But is it illegal in states? It's not, is it?
No, it's not illegal. Some towns have passed ordinances against it, but generally it is not illegal. It is illegal along the interstate highways, simply because it's illegal to be a pedestrian on the interstate, but you can hitchhike on the interstate on ramps and off ramps. I recently tried to do this in Berkeley, and with no success, actually. No one stopped to pick me up, and I really don't look like a very intimidating person.
And I can't help but think of one of the more insidious ways of discouraging hitchhiking is by saying, state penitentiary ahead, do not pick up hitchhikers. It just plants into your mind the fact that, wow, they're not just in this place, crazy people could be lurking to jump into your cars, but anywhere.
Yeah, that was an interesting thing that I saw when I looked at the whole history of the movement. The first public education campaign tried to convince you that the hitchhiker was the dangerous one, and then it very quickly reversed course and tried to convince people that it was actually, you know, dangerous to hitchhike, dangerous to the hitchhiker, because, you know, creeps were driving the roads in their cars. And we definitely all have a feeling, you know, if you're watching a movie and it's raining and somebody's car breaks down, or then they're trying to hitchhike, you know, to get out, you know that it's not going to end well. I think that, you know, one of the more positive things is that this is kind of changing today, that everybody having a mobile phone in their pocket and social media at hand immediately has made hitchhiking actually safer than it's ever been.
They just don't call it hitchhiking. It's called carpooling or ride sharing, right?
Or slugging. Yes. Right. There are lots of different names for it in different localities. It's hugely popular in Washington, of course, where Washington, D.C., where the traffic is just horrible.
For those of us who haven't used it, can you explain how the technology works and what some of the applications of it are?
Yeah, well, there are different registration systems available where drivers and riders can sign up, register, you know, and become kind of known personalities, and then use their phones even to find rides or to go to places that are pre-designated. It's more low tech than that in other places. Washington, D.C. has a pretty lively system where people line up at known spots. This is where it's called slugging. And they get in the car with people who want to drive in the high occupancy vehicle lanes. So there's a sort of mutual benefit to the rider and the driver. And I was really interested to note when I was visiting the federal transportation, the highway department in Washington, that they had a rideshare board and a slugging board. So the very people who are helping to keep the car culture going are also kind of realizing that we should really have more people in cars.
They also are making it more efficient for all of us.
Right. Fewer cars on the road. The more roads you build, the more cars will go on them. So there's a law of diminishing returns when it comes to building highways.
And that's one of the myths about traffic reduction as well. It's like, why don't they build another lane here? It actually never seems to alleviate traffic when you just build more road, right?
Right. If you build it, they will come.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to nonfiction author Ginger Strand. So you mentioned Washington, D.C. and its ride-sharing culture. What about Washington State? They've done some interesting stuff in terms of trying to connect their highway system to wildlife.
Yeah, that's a really interesting and positive development. Washington, a few years back, actually, became the first state to incorporate wildlife connectivity into their state transportation mandate. So if you're building something in Washington now as the highway department, you are required to factor in wildlife in the area. So people do studies and figure out whether wildlife are in fact crossing the highways and whether they need to build in wildlife crossings along the highways.
Is this a template we may see in other states?
I think it is a template. I've been seeing more of these wildlife crossings popping up. There are some really beautiful ones along the highways in New Jersey, surprisingly. But, you know, habitat fragmentation is a bigger and bigger problem. And people are beginning to realize that roads, you know, roads provide a barrier. It's not just that the animals can't get where they want to go, but that people end up hitting them and damaging their vehicles and, in the worst cases, themselves. So it's been more and more on the minds of the highway engineers to try to make the roads more sustainable in terms of what they have to interact with in the landscape.
She's nonfiction author Ginger Strand. Her book is Killer on the Road, Violence in the American Interstate. She also has a couple pieces coming up in Orion Magazine on how both communities and colleges are incorporating renewable power. Ginger, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you for having me.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by two special guests, one from New Zealand, Paul Minot. He is the co-founder of the Ride Sharing Institute, and Mark Svenvold, who is a professor of poetry and nonfiction writing at Seton Hall University and a journalist coming to us from New Jersey. Good to have you both on the show at the same time. Paul and Mark, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks.
Thanks, Alex.
So, Paul, if you can give us some insight into how ride sharing has transformed since you started working on it.
Thanks, Alex. How it's transformed since I started working on it is, I'd almost look at it and say there's been this shift or this drive towards technological solutions, and there's sort of a feeling that it's not going to be much fun if there isn't a tech solution, and that if somehow the iPhone can solve this problem, that would be kind of correct in the order of the way things are supposed to work. From a sort of a transcendental sort of a perspective. What I've seen, the Lyft and Uber taxi services are taxi services. They're really no different in their initial form that they've held for the first couple of years of operation. They are just taxis that use an app that is a bit smarter than what taxi companies have used. But the difference is that they can call on a much larger resource because anybody who's got a phone and a car can respond. And Mark's numbers about how, I won't argue with the numbers about how many cars are because I can't count them. There's a lot of cars out there. And so there's a lot of capacity that's sitting waiting to respond. However, the reality is with those services that they actually add trips. They actually add vehicle miles. If you were going to drive yourself and instead you called an Uber trip, that Uber car is going to come and get you. It's going to take you where you're going. It's going to drop you off. And then it's going to go back. Sometimes it might hang around, but that person really doesn't have a reason to be where you are. Whereas ride sharing, in a sense of what we want to do to change the traffic, is actually about saying, how do we take you in your trip while you're going to work and have somebody else ride with you? Not necessarily to your work, but to somewhere nearby. And the interesting question, I think, is what it takes for that to change in a sufficiently significant way that we have less traffic congestion. And, you know, a lot of these things are being developed in the San Francisco Bay Area. I was there in June and at an event that was put on by Agrion. One of the speakers was a innovation person from the Metropolitan Transport Commission. San Francisco is fantastic. You know, you've got BART and then you've got all of these other options. And with the reviving of the economy, which never really went that down that much in San Francisco, apparently, with the reviving of the economy, they are now having problems with getting people onto BART at 4:30 in the afternoon. So you've got traffic congestion out on the road, but you've also got people congestion on BART. You know, people are having to wait two or three trains before they can get on their ride home at 4:30 p.m. And so what I've seen develop is I've seen lots of ideas tested. I've honestly yet to see one that really is making a difference to the traffic. There are some small and interesting ideas, such as one that Mark talks about in the article, where perhaps you're just trying to find a like-minded person to travel in the traffic with. So it's about leveraging that time that's still going to be traffic. So the question is whether you're trying to set up an app to provide a service in the middle of everything that's going wrong, or as what I set out to do and still am pursuing, is trying to find something that solves the problem. And one of my conclusions is it's actually not a transportation engineering problem.
What is the problem then?
We use the system in a very dumb way. You know, so what happened was through the 50s, they built the interstate, and basically as the car expanded, the availability of the car expanded, the number of cars expanded, we were able to plow a new road through. We were able to expand the road. And at some point, public transport, and certainly, I mean, if you go back, public transport came first. In order to develop a suburb, in order to get people to and from your piece of land, if you were a developer, you provided some sort of a railway and then a road. And so what happened was the response to too many cars was, okay, we'll just expand the road. Well, as we all know, that method doesn't work anymore. And you can spend $3 trillion, it's an amazing number that Mark refers to. You can spend that and you can keep on trying to expand the roads and putting on public transport. But the sheer problem with the roads is that, you know, three quarters of the space, in fact, far more than three quarters of space is empty.
Is the best way to go about this having incentives through public policy? And what kind of policies do you think would catalyze this change? Or do you think this has to be coming from a grassroots movement and just from a basic need?
Well, it's a little bit of both. And as Paul has noted, you have to put a value on passengership. That's the phrase that I think is useful. Putting a value on passengership is necessary. And that's going to probably come from the private sector, and it's also going to come from the public sector as well. It's going to be a combination of these things. We have a situation, we've emerged, there are several presuppositions that are working in our sense of traffic. The dominant one is that the roads should be free, you know, should be able to free to ride the roads as however I want. But the problem with that is if it is free, then you end up with what we have now. And so there, as Paul was saying, we've got to find ways to incentivize people to switch to being passengers. Now, the recommendations from places like the Texas A&M, the Transportation Institute are, you know, adding some capacity, right? But also just using what we have and providing choices. That's one of the findings that this recent report says, giving people choices that might incentivize people. And also diversifying developmental patterns. I mean, if you just continually build outward away from the city, that is not going to help things at all. And there's this other sort of ontological problem, if you will, that's sort of dancing around that people are trying to understand is the notion of the car as an extension of the self. You know, the extension in an era where we have everybody's pressed for time, the automobile is one of these interior spaces where we are alone for once, you know, during the day. It's sometimes viewed as a sort of an extension of the living room. Is there a way in which we can address that problem? And part of it has to do with this whole idea of passengership, with the whole idea of making the transit system visible so that we know, and making communities aware that they actually, as a community, have a choice. There's this been hub and spoke idea where the center, the destination has been, you know, the employer. Everyone has been focused on the, you know, where people work as point B. That's, we have to all focus on that, build a database around, you know, the destination of the employer. And other companies like Karma in Austin and in San Francisco are saying, well, maybe it actually should start with the community. You know, maybe we need to build the database around communities first, and instead of working on a hub and spoke with the employer at the center, think of a fork model where you have communities along the tines of the fork that are nearby each other, actively engaged, and then all converging on the main arterial, if you will.
Baby, please don't drive me away. Baby, please don't drive me away. Though I love you, won't you by my side? My love for you, I can never hide. If you love me, you will hear my plea. Put me out and that's the end of me. Please, don't drive me away.
I've got a gas. Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidio.edu.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/seachangeradio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Paul Minot, the founder of the Ride Sharing Institute in Auckland, New Zealand, as well as Mark Svenvold, who's a journalist and professor at Seton Hall University. So what areas that are being explored right now beyond the glorified taxi cab sharing that we've been discussing, what are some of the efforts right now that have either of you most excited?
Well, I think that most of the technology for addressing traffic congestion already exists, and it really is about deploying it and also about working with the regulatory bodies. And what I mean by that, for instance, is let's say for one example, a technological thing that already exists is the radio RFIDs, radio frequency identification. If you know, more and more these things are being installed in cars, so that cars will, you know, the location of a car or locations of lots of cars are going to be findable, and that's corresponding to this whole realm of big data and big data analytics, where if you get a whole big set of these cars that are pinging away their frequency, you'll be able to analyze the traffic flows and predict congestion a little better. So there's a lot of work on that already being done. And the World Economic Forum has done some work on that. And traffic congestion centers in major cities are starting to think about these things. They're starting to be built and starting to work. And like Paul said, the autonomous car would probably play a part in all of that, but it in many ways the that's going to come head on with regulatory policies and issues of privacy and data security. So there's a lot of things that have to kind of fall into place for full deployment of these ride sharing issues and ride sharing technologies.
And Paul, what are you most excited about?
I've got to say I'm a pessimist in a sense that there's not a lot that's happening, in my view, that is moving towards finding a solution. But I do get excited when I hear about people trying new things to and actually getting out there and testing new ideas to find things that will work. There is a concept called shared use mobility that goes beyond just ride sharing. It includes bike sharing and car sharing. And I think that there's a need for an urban area to have a range of supporting solutions so that when you travel as a passenger, you aren't likely to get stranded. One of the problems of not taking your car is the feeling that I won't be able to get back. And so there needs to be, you know, a good guaranteed ride home service. There needs to be a cheap taxi service that's really available during the day when you're at work without your car. There needs to be bike share so you can get around and it needs to be inexpensive. There needs to be car share so that you can get around and it needs to be inexpensive. And all of these things, and the exciting thing is these are getting developed. You've got Car2Go, for example, you've got bike sharing coming in a lot of cities, and you've got guaranteed ride home. And then you also need circulator buses in the center. You need the buses sort of getting people around so you, when you arrive in one area of the city, you easily can get to another area of the city. These are all pieces that I think fit into a total picture that enables mobility. But they won't work if we just expect them to suddenly reach a tipping point that everybody's going to do something different without a lot of different thought about how we are putting this all together at the moment and what the incentives are, with only the price of parking being seen in people's minds as the marginal cost of jumping in my car and going. We haven't got enough there to attract them away from that. I don't think we're going to create the situation where people are attracted away. And I'm sorry to be pessimistic, but that's, at the moment, the direction that most people are going is they're waiting for the magical app that is going to solve the problem. And I can't see it coming along. Even the price of petrol doubling, if the price of gas doubles, there will be a lot of people who will hurt. But what they'll look for is a raise in pay so they can get back to the point where they can still go and drive. You know, driving is very difficult to get your head around what it will take to change that basic behavior of crawl out of bed and by default crawl into my car and drive to where I want to go.
Mark Svenvold and Paul Minot, thanks so much for being my guests on Sea Change Radio.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Samford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Luscious Jackson, Vanity Fair, and Charles Brown.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.